It is my great honor to introduce one whom we welcome as not only one of the greatest living Americans of this age, but one of the truly great Americans of all time, soldier, statesman, and patriot, General of the Army, Douglas MacArthur.
Grand entrances made before at Republican National Conventions, but never one quite like this. Temporary Chairman Walter Hallinan made his speech of introduction to General of the Army Douglas MacArthur, who obviously was waiting during the speech just underneath the bandstand out of sight. And as the last words were spoken, on came a great platoon of Chicago police holding their nightsticks, their billies, as if they were little guns. And they're having a big argument now. The police themselves have advanced down the center aisle all the way to the front of the rostrum. They're followed closely by General MacArthur, wearing a dark blue suit, white shirt, dark tie. Can't tell whether it's blue or black from here. There's Senator Nolan of California caught in the crush. It's the photographers who are making the crush, those industrious gentlemen who get the pictures you'll see in their newspapers tomorrow. The committee is caught between two layers of Chicago police. One group that preceded the general and the committee, and the other group that came right behind. They're stretched halfway down the center aisle now. Every person in the convention hall seems to be on his feet. And now General MacArthur has come to the rostrum. The crowd has seen him. He is shaking hands with Chairman Hallinan and will listen to the roar. Waving rolled up newspapers, the ladies waving a handkerchief enthusiastically as General of the Army Douglas MacArthur in a dark blue shirt suit stands there on the rostrum as his right hand on the speaker's desk turns to say a few words to Chairman Hallinan, who stands on his left. Herbert Hoover, former President of the United States, made a couple of grand entrances to Republican National Conventions, but none so dramatic, none so carefully worked out, thought out, and planned as this one has been. Somewhere down there in the party that rushed down with the police who CBS reported Jesse Salzner. I don't know how he got mixed up with the party, but he did indeed. A squad of police leading the way, then the committee with General MacArthur and a squad of police bringing up the rear. And those police are stretched all the way down the center aisle, halfway to the rear of the hall. You can imagine how the flash bulbs are twinkling. Imagine how the flash bulbs are crackling. Delegates standing up on their chairs shouting to the general, shouting words of encouragement and advice and greetings. The flag of Texas is waving rigorously back and forth. Many of the state standards lifted from their sockets and being waved. Arkansas, Nebraska, Georgia, Texas too, waving back and forth. And here he addresses the convention.
Fellow Americans, I now present with great pride the keynote of the Republican National Convention of 1952, General Douglas MacArthur.
Mr. Chairman, ladies and gentlemen, possibly never before has a soldier been called to a rostrum such as this to participate in the deliberations of a great political party. I approach the task in a spirit of humility, born of full understanding of my own marked limitations, but fortified by so solemn an obligation. In this unusual assignment, I feel a deep consciousness of the nature and gravity of the crusade upon which we now embark. A crusade to which all sound and patriotic Americans, irrespective of party, may well dedicate their hearts and minds and fullest effort. Only thus can our beloved country restore its spiritual and temporal strength and regain once again the universal respect. I speak with a sense of pride that all of my long life I have been a member of the Republican Party. As before me was my father, an ardent supporter of Abraham Lincoln. I have an abiding faith that this party, if it remains true to its great traditions, can provide the country with a leadership which, as in the days of Lincoln, will bring us back to peace and tranquility. Perhaps it is unnecessary here to indict the present administration for all of its tragic blunders, for that indictment has already found full expression in the resentments which have poured from the hearts of the American people from north to south, east to west, with no distinction of race, creed, color, or political affiliation. I know from the four corners of the land, I have seen, I have heard. It has been a spontaneous expression, reflecting a deep sense of fear that our leaders, in their insatiate demand for ever more personal power, might destroy the Republic and erase from the earth those mighty principles of government which brought to this land a liberty, a dignity, and a prosperity never before known. It has been an expression of faith in our ultimate destiny as a free people, an acknowledgement of individual responsibility in the achievement of that destiny, a vibrant testimonial that the love of liberty still burns unquenchable in the American heart. Many of the people who thus register the depth of their resentments do not fully comprehend the nature and degree of the policy misdirection which has brought us to fiscal instability, political insecurity, and military weakness. But they view with dismay the failures of our leaders in the short aftermath of victory, which causes us, the once proud and mighty victor, unceasingly to call upon every American mother to yield her sons in a fight for national survival, which causes us to submit to extortion and blackmail for the release of our citizens unlawfully detained by nations with which we are at peace, which causes us to deprive our beloved divisions committed to battle in Korea of the power and the means and the will to achieve victory, our country's traditional military goal. They view with dismay the alarming change in the balance of world power
arising from the tragic decisions taken by willful or guileless men representing us at Tehran, Yalta, Potsdam, and elsewhere. Those reckless men who, yielding to international intrigue, set the stage for Soviet ascendancy as a world power and our own relative decline. They view with dismay the tragic weakness of our leaders, reflected in their inability to rebuild our strength and restore our prestige even after our commitment to war in Korea more than 2 long years ago dramatically emphasized the inadequacy of our security preparations, reflected in their inability to conserve our resources even while they warn of national peril, reflected in their tolerance of corruption, or worse, in the higher positions of the public service. They view with dismay the rising burden of our fiscal commitments, the deprivation of the opportunity to accumulate resources for future security and family obligations, the growing tendency of government to control personal life and suppress individual freedom. Our people are desperate for a plan which will revive hope and restore faith as they feel the oppressive burden of the tax levy upon every source of revenue and upon every property transaction. As they see the astronomically rising public debt heavily mortgaging the industry, the well-being, and the opportunity of our children and our children's children. As they observe the rising costs of the necessities of life impairing the effectiveness of pensions, insurance, and other fixed incomes, and reducing the aged and infirm to appalling circumstances. They look to their leaders, but their protests are silenced by the grim warnings of the disaster of a possible total war. They see no sign of concern, hear no words of encouragement, find no basis for easing fear. Their every expression of hope for reduction in the tax burden is met by the angry rejoinder that taxes must go ever higher. There is no plan to transform extravagance into frugality, no desire to regain economic and fiscal stability, no prospect of return to the rugged idealism and collective tranquility of our fathers. They yearn to regain the religious faith and spiritual rectitude of the past. They remember the counsel of General Washington when he said in his farewell address, "Of all the dispositions and habits which lead to political prosperity, religion and morality are indispensable supports." In vain would that man claim the tribute of patriotism who should labor to subvert these great pillars of human happiness, these firmest props of the duties of men and citizens. But the people detect no heed given this wise counsel. They witness instead only a ceaseless effort to spend and spend, to tax and tax, only a callous indifference to mounting disclosures of graft and corruption and waste in the public administration. The religious devotion of the American people, which has produced the universally reflected spirituality of the American home, has been outraged by the materialism and selfishness which dominates the national administration. Public policy no longer is geared to the simple determination of that which is right and that which is wrong. The objective has been to build political strength even at the expense of the public interest. This is incomprehensible to our people, who understand fully the influence religion and morality have always exerted upon political stability. They know from the lessons of history that national strength and greatness inevitably find their true measure in existing moral and ethical standards. But one asks, how can it be that the party of Jefferson and Jackson, which once contributed so magnificently to the building of the Republic, would now sponsor and support so tragic a cleavage from our great tradition? How could it despoil these very concepts of humanity and government upon which rested our past spiritual and temporal strength? The answer is as clear as it is distressing. That party of noble heritage has become captive to the schemers and planners who have infiltrated its ranks of leadership to set the national course unerringly. To set the national course unerringly toward the socialistic regimentation of a totalitarian state. To such end, they have sought to circumvent the safeguards to our liberties wisely written into the Constitution of the United States. At one stage, there was even the attempt to subvert the independence of our Supreme Court by adding new members pliable to the will of the executive. At another, the claim of extraordinary inherent power without the slightest sanction in law. They have too frequently regarded that immutable charter as an instrument of political expediency. In the hypocrisy of self-righteousness, they hail their course as true liberalism. Yet every move they make to circumvent the spirit of the Constitution, every move they make to centralize political power, every move they make to curtail and suppress individual liberty is reaction in its most extreme form. For the framers of the Constitution were the most liberal thinkers of all the ages, and the charter they produced out of the liberal revolution of their time has never been and is not now surpassed in liberal thought. Our forefathers associated together into a sovereign state for the sole and only purpose of protecting their common liberties, not of yielding them again to a centralized federal authority. Their concept held to the primacy of the individual's interest, that of our present leadership to the predominance of the state. They who trample upon constitutional liberty by the undue centralization and imposition of political power are turning back the pages of history and gradually reinstituting those very excesses and abuses for which the British Crown was indicted in 1776 by our Declaration of Independence. They are the dangerous reactionaries in contemporary American politics. They have trifled with that great American institution, free, private, competitive enterprise. Keystoned the arch of our economic strength as a nation and prosperity as a people. By the imposition of oppressive and arbitrary controls upon business and production, by exhaustive taxation, which withers initiative, reduces energy, and in the end destroys the spirit of enterprise, by spendthrift policies which stagger the imagination, by discouraging adherence to the principle of private ownership of property, they have established the prerequisites to a socialistic, or even later, a communistic state. And as they thus chart a course with such reckless abandon leading toward ultimate national bankruptcy, they endeavor to mislead and control the public mind by a patronage of money, by devices calculated to create an artificial appearance of prosperity, and by a continuous flow of irresponsible and deceptive propaganda. But the people, in their innate wisdom, are not misled by such tactics of deception. Alert to reality, they know that the value of the dollar has diminished about 50% and is still going down. They find insufficient compensation in nominally higher income, however skillfully propagandized, as a mark of prosperity. They entertain a growing fear that the same policy misdirection which has debased the dollar will in time so impair our economy as to imperil the nation's solvency and thus destroy our living standards. With the dollar down, prices up, and taxes increased, a higher wage buys less today than yesterday. Tomorrow may be even worse. Let me read you this letter, illustrating how millions of American wage earners are losing their living standard. In 1941, I was working as a railroad telegrapher, as I am today. My weekly wage was $38.88. Subtracting $1.17 for railroad retirement, I had $37.71 take-home pay, no income tax. My weekly wage now is $71.32. But from that comes $4.46 retirement and $10.50 income tax. Net, $56.36. Also, the cost of living has gone up 189% in the meantime. My old take-home pay was equivalent to $71.27 today. But my take-home pay today actually is that $56.36. My loss in income is $14.91. In other words, after 11 years, and with no compensation for added experience or increased productivity due to technological developments, I have actually suffered a pay cut of about $15 per week. And so it is with all of us. In this march away from our traditional American standards, two of our former liberties have been left unimpaired. Rights and powers specifically reserved to state, community, and individual by constitutional mandate have been ruthlessly suppressed
by creeping federal authority. Reckless abuse has been made of that most dangerous of all sovereign powers, the power to tax. We find ourselves already past the point where higher taxes might be expected to produce higher revenue. The propaganda of fear is replacing our once dynamic initiative, well-tested vision, and unparalleled energy in a frantic effort to whiplash the country into a maximum of production. This misdirection of public policy, which so endangers survival of our traditional American way of life, finds its genesis in an alien and foreign philosophy, its application in American politics designed to further entrench a 20-year hold upon the political power. It emphasizes with startling clarity the sage warning of a wise and far-seeing Democratic leader of many years ago, Senator Benjamin Hill of the state of Georgia, who foresaw something of what has happened, but I dare say expected the responsibility would be chargeable to a Republican administration. He cautioned on the floor of the Senate of the United States, "I have said I do not dread industrial corporations as instruments of power to destroy this country, because there are 1,000 agencies which can regulate, restrain, and control them. But there is a corporation we may all well dread. That corporation is the federal government. From the aggressions of this corporation, there can be no safety if it is allowed to go beyond the well-defined limits of its power. I dread nothing so much as the exercise of ungranted and doubtful powers by this government. It is, in my opinion, the danger of dangers to the future of this country. Let us be sure to keep it always within its limits. If this great, ambitious, ever-growing corporation become oppressive, who shall check it? If it become wayward, who shall control it? If it become unjust, who shall trust it? As sentinels on the country's watchtower, senators, I beseech you, watch and guard with sleepless dread that corporation which can make all property and rights, all states and people, and all liberty and hope its playthings in an hour and its victims forever." How prophetic this warning. How far our institutions have been yielded to these very excesses of power which he so deeply feared. And this, ironically enough, under the stewardship of his own party. Let none say this is but a partisan conclusion, for north or south, east or west, men and women of whatever political faith recognize the tragic truth of this circumstance. But our failures in domestic policy can be overcome, for government takes its tone, its character, even its general efficiency from its leadership. Sound leadership can restore integrity to the public service, can economize in the public administration, can eliminate disloyal elements from public authority, can purge our educational system of subversive and immoral influence, can restore to youth its rightful heritage, can strengthen the fabric of our free economy, can raise the dollar to its true value, can reduce the tax burden on individual and industry, can regain the course of constitutional direction, can recapture personal liberties now impaired, can correct social inequities,
can strengthen the position of both worker and owner in private industry, even while protecting the public interest, can fortify the initiative, energy, and enterprise of the farmer so as to ensure the adequacy of the production of food in lean years and its distribution in those of plenty without being crippled by the unwarranted interference and domination of government, and can rearm the nation without undue burden upon the people. The correction of domestic evils and lapses would not be too difficult, provided the will to do so firmly exists. Foreign policy has been as tragically an error as has domestic policy. We practically invited Soviet dominance over the free peoples of Eastern Europe through strategic dispositions of Soviet force at the close of the European War. We deliberately withdrew our armies from thousands of square miles of hard-won territory, permitting the advance of Soviet forces to the west to plant the red flag of communism on the ramparts of Berlin, Vienna, and Prague, capitals of Western civilization. We recklessly yielded effective control over areas of vast uranium deposits without which the Soviet might never have developed the threat of atomic power. The murder by the Soviet of the flower of the Polish nation. And even after victory had been achieved, we continued to supply the Soviet with quantities of war material despite the clear and inescapable warnings of the Soviet threat to future peace. In the East, we gave over to the Soviet control of the industrial resources of Manchuria, the area of North Korea, and the Kurils, pointed at the heart of the Japanese home island. We condemned our faithful wartime ally, the Chinese people, to the subjugation of communist tyranny. And in the course of these moves, we proceeded with precipitate haste to divest ourselves of our own military strength. Despite the threat to our security then clearly apparent, our executive flaunted and ignored the judgment and will of the Congress, which appropriated funds for the expansion of our air arm, which he arbitrarily refused to expend for such purpose. Small wonder, indeed, that from the combination of these tragic decisions and events, there occurred a reversal of the balance of world power such as history has never before recorded. Then suddenly, with our military strength standing at possibly the lowest relativity in history, our divisions in Japan reduced from 3 to 2 regiments, our regiments from 3 to 2 battalions, our battalions from 3 to 2 companies, with our protection withdrawn from South Korea as a militarily indefensible peninsula, we there and then plunged our forces into war to defend it. Few would take exception to the impulse, however idealistic, to support the preservation of freedom where we had done so much to implant the principles and spirit of freedom. But it is fatal to enter any war without the will to win it. criticize not the morality of the decision, but its irresponsibility and recklessness. We defeated the North Korean armies, but when the communist armies of China struck, our leaders lacked the courage to fight to a military decision, even though victory was then readily within our grasp. A victory which would not only have discharged our commitment to the Korean people, but which in the long run might well have saved continental Asia from red domination. And after discarding victory as the military objective and thereby condemning our forces to a stalemated struggle of attrition and the Korean nation and people to progressive obliteration, we again yielded to communist intrigue and entered into protracted armistice negotiations, even though every lesson of experience had clearly shown such negotiations to be but the means whereby such an enemy gains time to reinforce his military capabilities. While I have not been consulted with reference to Korea since my retirement from active assignment 15 months ago, I can unhesitatingly say that a leadership which by weakness and indecision has brought about such a military dilemma lacks the soundness of vision, the moral courage, and the resolute will to resolve it. But resolved it must be, or we cannot long carry so intolerable a burden. We must have a leadership capable of decision, as indecision in war is but the prelude to disaster. No military problem is unsolvable. Korea stands today as the hallowed graveyard for countless American dead. We must not let it become as well a graveyard for American hope, American faith, and American honor. In Europe, and indeed throughout the world, our foreign policy approach has been equally as vacillating and negative, and for the most part, sad indeed to relate, under the domination of others. We have yielded to selfish pressures both at home and abroad, and in so doing have unduly directed the distribution of our wealth into privileged channels, have taken sides in international disputes which were fundamentally none of our affair, and have endeavored to impose our will on other nations' purely domestic problems in an imperialistic manner. We have ignored traditional friends while showering our favors on others, and we have lost that sense of judicial fairness which formerly characterized our relations abroad. In our preoccupation with Europe, we have tended to discard from our concern those great peoples of Asia and the Middle East who historically have sought not our wealth, but our friendship and understanding. Our good neighbor policy with respect to the peoples of Central and South America, of greater strategic concern than all others, has been largely subordinated. Through the paternalistic attitude which has dominated our material assistance abroad, we have promoted as much weakness as strength as much resentment as friendship. Animated by the doubtful belief that with money alone we could erect internal bulwarks against communism's growth, our leaders have expended much of our resource on the area of Western Europe. Events have largely established the fallacy of this reasoning. Indeed, the history of mankind shows clearly that the love of liberty is a spiritual resource of the human heart, which, if non-existent, does not spring from money alone. None will quarrel with the impulse to do all reasonably within our power to assist the best effort of the peoples of Western Europe to prepare their bastions for self-defense. But communism, with its recently acquired strategic frontiers in Asia and Europe, and its penetration elsewhere by internal minority influences, presents a worldwide problem, the solution of which involves consideration of every point of possible communist pressure. One would be foolhardy indeed to quench a fire in the kitchen while leaving another room aflame. The problem is global, not sectional. Nor would the free world be the gainer if our own nation, from its conception in liberty, has ever stood as a beacon of hope and inspiration, should so exhaust itself of spiritual and material resource as to render its own survival subject to the will of others. Such a tragedy would return civilization to the darkness of the Middle Ages, and the ideal of human liberty might perish from the earth. But the present administration ignores the lessons of history, however clear and unmistakable. It ignores the practical aspect that there is a limit even to our own vast resources. It ignores the fact that our potential strength rests not so much upon any natural advantages which we have and others have not, but upon the initiative and vision, the enterprise and courage, the sweat and toil, which alone spring from the incentive of freedom. Destroy such incentive, and our nation can go the way of many others toward a universal level of mediocrity, a standard of life measured by the lowest common denominator, which is communism's ultimate goal. The administration is obsessed by the idea that we can spend ourselves into a position of leadership abroad just as it believes we can spend ourselves into prosperity at home. Both are based upon illusory premises. Both challenge economic and social truths deeply rooted in the experience of mankind. World leadership can only rest upon world respect. Such respect is one of those spiritual ideals which do not result from gifts, propaganda, salesmanship, or any artificial means. It is not for barter to the highest bidder. It is not within the orbit of international trade. It is influenced solely by the soundness of the ideas by which we better our own civilization, elevate to higher standards our own way of life, and strengthen the dignity of our own citizenry. Only through the exemplification of sound ideas, which in the crucible of experience have produced for us a better and more serene life, may we contribute in fullest measure to the well-being of others. The higher our own standard and more stable we become, the greater our appeal to less fortunate peoples, and the more they will look to us and our ways for guidance and leadership, the supplies equally to those behind the Iron Curtain and those still blessed by the concept of human freedom. For the whole record of civilization proves that the tyranny has not as yet been devised which can long resist a sound idea. Spiritually and physically, we possess the resource, properly conserved and realistically applied, to lead toward a world freed from the exhausting wars which have so plagued the past. This is a practical purpose, not visionary, for the destructiveness of modern war has now in the atomic age become too frightful to contemplate by even a potential victor. This, then, must be the direction of our foreign policy. We must, upon restoration of our military strength and spiritual balance recklessly dissipated in our headlong retreat from victory, chart from that strength a true and unequivocal course to peace and tranquility, a peace and tranquility which will be real, not fictitious, deep-rooted, not superficial. Our ideal must be eventually the abolition of war. Such is the longing hope of all of the masses of mankind of whatever race or tribe. Indeed, so well is this understood that even the despot, in order to assure a following, cloaks the threat or application of force with a hypocritical pretense that his purpose is to secure the peace. But rarely has the present administration made a major move calculated to strengthen the fabric of world peace. To the contrary, it has done much to advance the danger of global strife by its indecisive conduct of the campaign in Korea, with its shameful implication that we dare not strike back at those who strike at us. By its bellicose attitude toward all who oppose it in international diplomacy, and by its pattern of collective security agreements, which, without as yet having mounted either the will or the physical power to successfully meet aggression, have divided the world into armed camps and rendered us dependent not alone upon the wisdom of our own foreign policy to keep us out of war, but upon the foreign policies and diplomatic moves of other nations as well. We must fully understand that once we commit ourselves to the defense of others, the issue of war or peace is no longer in our exclusive hands, or we become but another pawn in the game of international power politics, a dangerous game in which the present administration has demonstrated no peculiar adeptness. It has talked and pledged peace while moving toward war. Indeed, none can deny what history so clearly records, that the Democratic Party has well earned the doubtful distinction of being a war party of modern American politics. The dead of World War I, of World War II, and of the Korean War render mute testimony. We must remain faithful to the commitments we have made to others so long as they remain faithful to theirs made to us. But failure of the principle of collective security in Korea, where we have found ourselves holding responsibility without corresponding authority, plainly warns that too much must not be expected from collective security elsewhere. Indeed, in Western Europe, as in Korea, experience has shown a reluctance by many of the Allies to assume a fair and rightful share of the military burden, even though in the case of Western Europe, the basic purpose would be the defense of its own soil. This hesitancy does not spring from any insufficiency of manpower nor the exhaustion of other needed resource, but rather from a seeming confident assurance that this nation's blood and treasure will be committed to the fullest extent needed to accomplish the military objective. The free peoples of Asia and the Middle East do not ask for American garrisons to defend their soil. All they seek is the necessary military equipment beyond their own capacity of production. They have both the will and the adequate men, if properly equipped, themselves to conduct their defense and to turn the tide decisively against communism. There is no logical reason why the same solution should not apply with respect to all others. In such circumstance, it should be our unalterable purpose to effect in due time withdrawal of our ground garrisons from service abroad. By far, our nation's greatest resource is our youth. In 20 bitter campaigns, I have witnessed its magnificence in the most trying experience of all, that of the battlefield. It has never failed our faith, never failed an invincible courage and a patriotism which subordinated life itself to duty. Yet as it now approaches the responsibility of civic leadership, it is confronted with a situation made almost desperate by the loss of such opportunity and resource as was our own heritage from the past. This is the greatest tragedy of all, that a national administration could have so yielded to the disease of power as to betray the youth of America. Despite stresses and strains, the fine basic character of the American people remains unimpaired. It offers hope that under the inspiration of a strong moral leadership, the people, all the people, will hurl back insidious efforts to sow the seeds of suspicion, distrust, and hatred calculated not only to stir up racial or religious strife between the several segments of our society, but to destroy the unity and common understanding which has been the cornerstone to our growth as a nation. The very survival of our liberties, and indeed our civilization, is dependent upon our citizenry of all races, creeds, and colors, standing firmly and invincibly together with a singleness of purpose a mutuality of faith, and a common prayer. God bless America. It is this spiritual unity which offers assurance that the coming crusade to rechart the nation's course toward peace and security and prosperity will find an aroused countryside ready and eager to march. That crusade rests upon the humanitarian aspirations of mankind, its constitutional rights, and the moral necessity for human happiness. It demands a purification of the nation's conscience and a refortification of its will and faith. Therein lies the Republican Party's challenge to leadership. At the close of the Constitutional Convention, George Washington remarked to Benjamin Franklin that he believed the Constitution as finally evolved was a great and noble charter of liberty upon which the several states could rally, unite, and prosper. Yes, General Franklin responded, if we can make it work. We have made it work in the days of our great past, and come November, we will make it work again. Help us, God.
Just before General MacArthur entered, but it was apparent that a great many of the spectators must have been out visiting the refreshment stands in the corridors just outside the main auditorium, because we couldn't see a seat vacant while the general was speaking. A good many of the delegates now moving out of their chairs and not moving into the aisles for any sort of real demonstration. They seem to be moving toward the back of the hall as if they were going to leave when the miscellaneous business, that is the last item on the program this evening, is done. There's not going to be the kind of rip-roaring demonstration in the aisles for General MacArthur, the kind that is usually made after the nominating speeches for each of the candidates. Harold Stassen, wearing a brown business suit, the brown tie, has made his way somehow to the runway. In the midst of the crush, he's shaking hands with General MacArthur and congratulating him. General MacArthur, of course, is Harold Stassen's old boss when Mr. Stassen was a naval officer in the Pacific. Joe Martin, the permanent chairman, who won't be installed until tomorrow, is there too? In the crush, and now the general has broken clear of all the obstacles and all the traffic, and he is leaving in an opposite direction. He's coming out, going to leave the hall apparently just underneath this radio booth. He came in the rear entrance, you know, marched all the way down the center aisle, made that great entrance, and now he is departing behind the face of Abraham Lincoln, which is just underneath this radio booth and is just directly in front of one of the rails of one of the balconies, all decorated in red, white, and blue bunting. Leaving the hall very quickly after his speech, much more quickly than many people thought. Now, here's Dallas Townsend.
Well, the delegates are still absorbing the effects of that speech by General MacArthur, a keynoter, which, as Bill Downs said before he made it, was going to be a humdinger, and it certainly was. Now, we'll be back in a minute, but first, let's swing over to Olin Tice for
the speaker's platform. The lights dimming out slowly, the movie lights down there in the auditorium. Senator Capehart of Indiana was recognized by Chairman Hallinan. Senator Capehart made a motion that the convention should stand adjourned until 11:30 tomorrow morning, Chicago time, 12:30 Eastern Daylight Time. It didn't take long for the delegates who were already clogging the aisles to shout aye. Just before that, though, Chairman Hallinan announced a meeting of the Committee on Rules in the Havana Room of the Blackstone Hotel immediately following this session. That means in about 30 minutes when the delegates get back into Midtown Chicago. So you can see the business of the convention goes on sometimes far into the night, even while sessions are not being held here in the auditorium. Well, it has been a great night indeed. The keynote night always is at a convention. The first evening session, the convention is just beginning to roll. People are beginning to get the feeling of it. The permanent chairman won't be installed until tomorrow, and this was the first big night. A number of us CBS reporters and correspondents have been watching the speech, listening to the speech as it was made from various parts of the hall. And so we're going to have a little talk here in the CBS radio booth and see what we all thought of it. I might start off myself by simply saying that it seemed to me a great deal like most keynote speeches, as a matter of fact, especially if you read it before you heard General MacArthur read it. I think the special qualities came from General MacArthur's personality, the fact that it was he himself delivering it, special qualities from his own special delivery and his vocabulary. The attacks on the opposition, I think, were similar to those many of the other party orators make, and I think that that's particularly noticeable, as I say, when you read the speech. It seemed to be that General MacArthur viewed with alarm, but did almost no pointing with pride. He flayed the Democrats without giving very much praise to the achievements of the Republicans, and in all these things, therefore, I think it was pretty much a standard keynote speech with, of course, the special MacArthur touches. Now, Edward P. Morgan, you're here with me in the booth, having come up from the stage where you heard the speech. Do you agree? What do you think of it?
Bob, in an atmosphere charged and drenched with emotion, such as this one has been, the applause which was given to the general on his entrance into the hall and the sustained applause during the speech, it's hard for a reporter to sit down and try to sort out some cold facts objectively about the significance of what General MacArthur said. But perhaps two things of significance come from what he did not say rather than what he did. For instance, he did not say anything that would either rule him out or thrust him forward as a candidate for the presidency as a party nominee himself. He still remains a possible dark horse, and his presence here today has been the occasion for many of his backers to get out and plump for him. The second thing involves whether his stand of criticism would be very obvious against General Eisenhower. He did not, as some thought he might, lash out directly against General Eisenhower, his former subordinate and a man against whom he is supposed to harbor still a feeling of bitter rivalry and jealousy. There was one part in the speech which could possibly be equated as a statement beamed directly or indirectly at the general when he said, "We foolishly permitted the encirclement of Berlin by Soviet forces, rendering almost inevitable the tragically high cost we have had to pay to secure lines of security and communication between our zones in Germany."